Connecting the Light. My guest today is Scott Alan Roberts. He's a long-time talk show host and researcher in the field of unexplained phenomena. He's also a very active author, and we are going to discuss his latest book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. So, thank you very much for coming onto the program, Scott. You're very welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. I sure appreciate it. And I will forewarn you, I office in my home, and I have small children and dogs that love to interrupt me while I'm on the radio. So I apologize ahead of time if you hear shrieking children.
Well, as long as that doesn't mean you're strangling one of them, we're all right.
Yeah.
Right, anyway, I have to say, if I wasn't me, I could easily be you, because I do love the idea of researching subjects, and I wonder how long you spent on this one. Did it take you very long to gather your information?
Oh, my. The actual physical completion of the book was probably the shortest period of time in the whole process.
Oh, was it?
I said in the very beginning of the book, it's much more daunting completing a book than it is writing a book. Mm-hmm. And I probably put about 15 years of thought into this. It was, you know, it wasn't active the whole time, but it was, the questions were all active, and I wanted to find out the answers. And it wasn't until I really hunkered down to write the book that I said, okay, I know these facts in my head, but now I got to research this all out and make sure I have the right idea, I'm on the right track, and I even learned things in the process of writing the book that I wasn't aware of. And since I've written the book, there are things that I'm already been asked to write the follow-up to this book, and I'm working on that. And the things that are coming out that are not included in this book are just mind-boggling even to me. So it's a continual process is what I found.
Yes, I can see that, because on your on the information I was passed, I gather you are already writing a book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, and it strikes me that you probably come across lots of different information that you can sort of put in categories, ready to write another book.
Definitely, and the reptilian book is just going to pick up the trail where I leave off in the first book on the Nephilim. And something I find as I'm going through this, my background is in theological studies. I was in a very conservative, fundamentalist Baptist background, and I went to Bible college and seminary. And these are where my thought processes started on these things. I started asking the questions that didn't seem to have satisfactory answers. And the more I asked, the more I drifted further away, because I wasn't getting answers. It seemed like that they were really looking for the solid answer. They wanted to give pet answers or answers within the box of theology, and that really bothered me. And
yes.
So the more I looked, the more I found information. And that's the same thing with this next book that's picking up where this one leaves off. It's the same thing. And I find that I will ask questions, and I will get theological answers that start to sound really sound and solid until you start comparing it to archaeological answers or anthropological answers or mythological answers. And then you start putting it all in that big blender and you say, okay, I need to find out how this all works together. And that was really what culminated in this book.
Right. So were you able to use much information from the Bible, or is it a bit unreliable?
Well, I found that my starting point was the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And the reason I started there, first of all, it was because that was what my background was in. And I wanted to research out what I was taught and what I wasn't taught within those pages and find out what was really there. And I have found that I run across differing kinds of thought on this. People that will say, well, here's a good for instance. In some of the reviews done on my book out there, I was taken to task because I'm preaching Jesus and I am pushing fundamental Christianity, and they hate my book for that. And then the next review would say, I'm pushing the alien agenda and totally calling the Bible fake, and so they hate my book for that. And I want to ask, well, which one do you think it really is? Because I didn't do either of those things. I find that the Bible has some reliability, but once you, as with anything, when you start adding dogma and theology and making religion out of those things, that's where you start closing the doors and shutting the windows to other possibilities. And that's when it becomes, I think, problematic. To say that the Bible is infallible, that's a faith issue. To say that it is unreliable historically, that's just nonsense, because there's plenty of history in the Bible. So you have to look at the Bible from different aspects. And the only way you can really come across and say it's the infallible truth, the Word of God, and so on, you have to be within that framework of theology and believe that by faith, because it's just another version.
Right. Now, I think one thing that we must clear up here, in case somebody's wondering about this, what is the definition of Nephilim?
All right. Definition of Nephilim, it's... this is another answer to that same question of why did I really go into the biblical study. The Old Testament is the source point of the word Nephilim. It's been used and sometimes overused, even to the point of pop cultural aspects in the movies and comic books, and it's becoming almost synonymous with this whole ancient alien thing, but I have not yet seen anything out there that's accurate when they get into the pop cultural aspect. But I chose the biblical study on this because of the source point word, which is the Hebrew Bible. And the word itself is the Hebrew word, the base word is nephal, which means to come down, to fall, to descend, to leave one's estate and go to another. And the him on the end, the im suffix, is a Hebrew suffix to the word which denotes plurality. And so it would be those who fell, those who came down, those who left their estate and came to another place. And so that's what the word Nephilim means all by itself. And one of the misnomers about these characters is that they are ancient aliens of some kind or ancient spirit beings when they're nothing of the sort. All the Nephilim are the offspring. And they're the offspring of this mingling between human women and non-human fathers, as the biblical story puts it, and frankly, 600 different ancient cultures have the same version of stories, all linked to a great flood story in ancient times. And the Bible is no different. The story of the Nephilim is the preamble to the flood story of Noah and the Ark in the Old Testament. It's the prelude to the flood, and it's an intricate part of the flood. And so when you look into other religious mythologies, if you will, all of their flood stories that exist, between 600 and 1,000 of them, frankly, you will find that all those flood stories have as a common thread some kind of spirit being or non-human entity that came to the earth, impregnated human women, bequeathed a race of hybrids, and some god, deity, superior power of some kind was really angry about this and came in to wipe them out with a great deluge. And so this is what the Nephilim are. It's the Hebrew version of this story.
Right. Now, when you talk of the flood, are we referring to the flood, must have been a great flood indeed, when Atlantis sunk, or are we talking about a more recent period when the gods got angry with the people on the earth and they created a flood? And I think I'm referring to the Sumerian period.
Yes. Well, we're talking about the Sumerian period. We're talking about the great flood of Noah. As we know, everybody, whether you're Christian or Jewish or not, almost everybody knows the story of Noah and the Ark. I mean, you can go down to the local toy store and buy the play school kit, even, of Noah and the Ark and the animals. And nobody...
Right.
It's almost as if it's been... no pun intended, a watered-down story over the ages, and it's not even a biblical story at times, unless you know what the story's all about. So, we're talking about the Great Sumerian Flood, a flood that took place between 6,000 and 7,000 years B.C., somewhere in that range of time is what we're looking at. And now, if Atlantis is connected to that, I know there are differing trains of thought on this. Some people want to connect that to Atlantis. Some people want to connect the continental shift to the Great Flood that took place in the Sumerian era. Of course, in the Bible, we're taught that it was a universal flood, and it covered the tops of every mountain. Now, we don't know if that's exaggeration or if that's pre-continental shift, if it had something to do with glacial melt and the continents shifted. There's all these different theories about it, placing it in totally different time periods. But this is a simple answer. I love to give 10,000 words where somebody else could say it in 40. But, this would be in the Sumerian flood that we're talking about, the same as the Gilgamesh epic, the same as Noah's flood and so on.
Mm. Right. So are the Nephilim also known in ancient history by any other name?
They are. As a matter of fact, you find them, as I mentioned, in many different cultures, hundreds of different cultures. The Nephilim... let's see. Probably one of the. Let me correct that statement. I'll backtrack just a touch. It's not so much the Nephilim that are pointed out in other. In other stories and other mythologies by name. It is their parentage that you hear more about, and that they bequeath these races. And the parentage, you see this as early as the Sumerian culture, where they talk about. Now, Zechariah Sitchin wrote a great deal about the Sumerian culture and the Anunnaki. And I think he was onto something, even though I take him to task on a couple of things linguistically, and I think he squeezed and pushed a lot of square pegs into round holes to create his theories. But I think he was onto something, because if you go back to the base story of the Sumerians, you've got that same story where the Anunnaki, a caste of star gods, of the ancient Sumerians, came down and bred up humans and enslaved them. And this is the same basic story you've got going on with what happened in the Genesis account. And it kind of mixes over. You've got the Genesis account of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden story, the creation of humankind. Then you've got the flood story, and the Sumerian culture has kind of all of these things. Only 3,000 years earlier it was written. And they've got some of these, all these same elements, and you'll see there's etymology of language, evolution of names of gods, and so on, that end up being the same gods you find in the Hebrew Bible 3,000 years later.
That must have made your task of researching the subject somewhat difficult when all these different names come up for the same gods. Now, indeed. I believe the Sumerians actually referred to the Anunnaki as beings that came from heaven to earth.
Yes. And some have extrapolated that to mean from the stars, from the heavens. I think that was one of the things Sitchin did, but there are others who have done translation of the ancient cuneiform texts that say the same thing and don't come to all the same conclusions as Sitchin. But what you've got happening in the ancient Sumerian story, in kind of a nutshell, is this caste of gods came to the earth. They bred up humans who they found, as the old texts say in the Sumerian culture, they found them roaming as wild beasts in the fields and the swampy regions of the backwaters of the Euphrates and the Tigris River Valley. And they bred them up for one specific purpose, and that was to do work for them, to till their gardens, to on a much grander scale, to agriculture, to mine resources and things like this. And the chief god of the Anunnaki was a god named Elil, E-L-I-L. And Elil was in charge of all of this, and his half-brother god, Enki, also known as Ea in the Akkadian text, Sumerian-Akkadian text there. Sumer and Akkad were right next door neighbors to each other. In the Akkadian text, he's known as Ea. In Sumeria, he's known as Enki, the brother god to Elil. He sees the plight of the humans, and he comes down, in a sense, breaks away from the rest of the gods. And he teaches forbidden knowledges to the humans and breeds them up again. And he does this all from a place that the passages call the Den of Serpents. And this becomes his, in the vernacular, his headquarters, so to speak, from where he teaches these forbidden knowledges. And he and his followers fall away from the rest of the gods, teach the humans the forbidden knowledges, breed them up, and in a sense, Enki-Ya becomes this, for all practical purposes, this freedom fighter for humans. And he operates out of the serpent's den, which becomes known as Ea's den or Ea-den. And you start making the comparisons now to the Genesis story, which took place 3,000 years later, and that took place, which were written about 3,000 years later, the stories in Genesis, and you have, first of all, Elil is the superior god, the chief god of the Anunnaki in the Sumerian culture. Well, El is the same name, E-L, for the etymologically speaking, as it evolved down into the Canaanite region, the Hebrews picked that up, and El is the same base word for God. El, Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, the archangels had Michael, Gabriel, Raphael. This El was present in everything. It was the name for God. Then you also have Enki, also known as Ea, the god who broke away and worked for the humans and gave them the forbidden knowledges. His name Ea, E-A is the spelling, is the same basic, as you follow the etymology or the evolution of language, his name is the same base word for YWH, the Yahweh, or Jehovah, as it's known. Yahweh is the Hebrew word. So Ea became Yahweh in the Hebrew culture. And you start looking at the similarities where Ea, Enki Ea, was teaching the humans forbidden knowledges. He brought them knowledge, and he bred them up. And he did this within the den of snakes, the den of serpents, Ea's den. And you start comparing it to the serpent issue in the Garden of Eden story. You look at the fact that the Anunnaki had enslaved the people, and one of the things they had humans doing was they had them tilling the land for them. What does the Genesis story of creation say? It says that God created Adam and Eve and placed them in the garden.
Well, it's been very interesting so far. When you spoke about the hybrids, are they a particular race that we can identify today?
No, I don't think you can identify them. It's not like saying this race over in this country, they are Nephilim. They are part of the hybrid race. It's non-identifiable by current-day standards. What you do have are hints that it may be, and so you can speculate, but that's about it. And one of the things that you will see is, I know one of the issues that come in, this is pure speculation, but when they discovered the Rh factor in blood in the 1950s, they still to this day say that that is unlike anything else on a DNA level or a genetic level with anything on this planet that they know of. And so it's unique in and of its own. And it doesn't relate to anything else. So there is some speculation that that random gene is found in the Rh factor of blood, which is a rare type of blood. You see in biblical stories, you found the Nephilim were mentioned over and over again in obscure passages. You know, one of the most famous ones after the story of the Nephilim and the flood was, of course, Goliath of Gath and his three brothers. And we know the story of David and Goliath. And Goliath had three brothers from the town of Gath, and it said that they were all the sons of Anak, the children of the Nephilim. And he's said to be 6 cubits in a span. So he was said to be 9'2", thereabouts, would have been his height. So they were big, giant warrior types. And this ties in, of course, to some of the descriptors of the Nephilim in the book of Genesis. It calls them, in the passage that talks about them, it says, and the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. They were known as the heroes of old and the men of renown. And that men of renown is a term in the Hebrew tongue, which referred to the Giborim in the Hebrews, to the Hebrews. And these were these giant, great, mighty men of valor, warriors, and so on. And you see remnants, you see obscure passages. Is there any way to really trace, physically, scientifically trace the bloodline of the Nephilim? No, because we don't have a source point. We don't know. We don't have any data to go on. All we have is speculative data and extrapolation of information to say this looks like it could be this. So I don't think we can physically trace them. If you get into spiritual sides of things, one of the books where you find the Nephilim written about to great extent is the Hebrew Book of Enoch. And it was an apocryphal book, meaning under the reign of Constantine, the emperor of Rome, and under his councils, they banished certain books from the Bible because they could not come to unanimous terms on whether or not they were God-breathed in Scripture. So they took them out of the canon of Scripture and put them into apocryphal books. And in the Book of Enoch, Enoch states to great extent he talks about the Nephilim, and he also mentions toward the ends of his accounts that the spirits of the Nephilim who died on this earth, that because they were born on the earth, they are bound to the earth. And being bound to the earth in spirit form, he said they brought corruption to mankind in their corporeal form. Therefore, they will continue to bring corruption in their spirit form down through the ages. And some people have theorized that this is the demonic caste or the evil spirit caste that exists out there. And again, now that's on the spiritual level, so it's subjective. You can't prove it. But somebody who works with that stuff intimately will tell you, yes, it exists, and this is one of the explanations for it.
Right. Now, you must have seen over the last few years the discovery of enormous skeletons with very large heads, and I'm thinking about what you said about the giants being 9 foot. I think some of these were even taller. They thought that one was possibly a hoax, but there have been, I think, quite a number of them, and I think you can discount the hoax in each case. Now, do you think that is the same race of giants that are referred to?
Very possibly. I think a lot of those, to me, they appear to be hoaxes. When you see the pictures on the internet and things like that, there are very few of those that are authentic pictures. I've been a designer all my life and a digital artist all my life, and I can see in a heartbeat when something's been digitally manipulated or not. And most of those photos I've seen have been. Now there are some giant skulls that they have. I want to say it's in the Jerusalem Museum, but I might be incorrect about it. It's either in the Middle East or Eastern Europe. There are some skulls in museums there that they don't put on public display because they have no explanation for them. They do exist, though. And these skulls, with absent the rest of the body, by just the measurements of the skulls, would create beings that could be anywhere from 9 to 12 feet tall. Now, are these Nephilim? I don't know for sure. All I know is this. When you look at, the King James Version of the Bible, and you look at the source point for the word Nephilim in Genesis 6, it calls them giants. It doesn't call them Nephilim. Well, giants, the word giants for Nephilim is a mistranslation, and was for years. There are words in the Hebrew and in the Aramaic that there's Nephilim, there's Nephilim, and there's several little words where there's just one little jot or tittle that's out of place, and it creates a totally different word. Well, the word had been mistranslated as giant when, in fact, it meant to fall, to come down, and so on, as I had mentioned earlier. So the only place we extrapolate any kind of definition of giant is from the Giborim, which are mentioned by the phrase the mighty men of valor and the heroes of old. And so they were giants. We see in other places in the Old Testament where they're talked about as being tall and big. I already mentioned Goliath. When Moses led the Exodus out of Egypt and they came to the land of Canaan and they sent out spies, the spies went into the land and came back and said, "We can't go in there. The Nephilim are there, the children of Anak. They're giants. They make us look like grasshoppers in their sight." And that was the report they brought back. So,
I've heard that expression before. Now, going back to Sumeria, they used to depict the Anunnaki, who were royalty to them, as being very, very much bigger than the Sumerians themselves. Now, do you think that they were also the giants?
I don't know for certain that they were giants. I know that there is some information that says they were bigger in stature. There is some illustrative carvings that show them, at relief work that shows them as being bigger. And here's where you have to get into the anthropology of it all, because an anthropologist who doesn't want to use any kind of religious belief or extrapolate any spiritual information about anything, they will tell you that this is just the way they were depicted, that it could have been, you said a key phrase there, the royal ruling class of the Sumerians. And they were called the Anunnaki, and they ascribe, just like they did in ancient Egypt, you saw how a pharaoh was known as the brother of God when he became the pharaoh. He became a god. Did he literally become a god, or is that what was ascribed to him because of their religion and their spirituality? And so you could have the same thing anthropologically speaking when you talk about the Anunnaki, or you see races like the half-fish, half-man people in the Sumerian legends, Oannes, the god, half-man, half-fish god, who came up out of the Persian Gulf at night with his the daytime, and taught forbidden knowledges or knowledges to humans and civilized them, and every night to go back to the Persian Gulf. Were these actually literal fish man people, or is this something that they ascribe to them, and the carvings you see are maybe costumes that high priests wore or something? That's what an anthropologist might tell you. And of course, let me put one caveat in here. Everything I'm saying here is kind of Nephilim light right now. We're having a conversation on the radio. To dig into this stuff really deep, we could spend 10 hours talking about just one facet of any of this. I'm making some very broad general statements here as we're going, just for sake of simplicity. I think you can have an anthropological explanation, you can have a literal explanation.
Right, now when you were talking about the blood types, it did jog my memory that someone alleged to have found traces of the blood of Jesus, and I recall he had a very rare type of blood. Do you think there was any connection with his genes and the gods?
Well, I think this. I can give you a faith description of what I believe about Jesus, and we don't have to get into that for this conversation. There's a faith aspect, and then there's trying to decipher the historical and the literal. One thing I will say is this. It's interesting that in the Old Testament, when God talks about these beings who came down to the earth and impregnated human women and bequeathed the Nephilim, they were known as the sons of God, or in the Hebrew, the Bene HaElohim. They were the sons of God, the Elohim of heaven. They weren't angels, which is a mistranslation as well. The word angel never appears anywhere. And I think you could go so far as to say, what was Jesus called and known as in the New Testament? By the way, Christianity, all Christianity is a sect of Judaism that believes the Messiah came, while the other part of Judaism does not, in oversimplistic terms. So Jesus was a son of God, and I didn't see him ever described in the Hebrew as a Bene HaElohim, but as a son of Elohim, but it's the same terminology translated into the English, son of God. Now, you've got these, and this is where, here's what I say. When I talk about the Nephilim, there's like several spots on a, draw an imaginary timeline, and there's several spots on the timeline that we can start referencing, and we got to keep jumping back and forth between each other to build the case for what it really exists here. And Jesus, according to Christianity, was the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies. He was the Messiah, come in the flesh. But if you've ever gone to church at Christmas time or been around Christianity at Christmas time, what do they say about Jesus? He came to the earth. He was one of us, they'll say. There's a big importance put on the fact that he was totally human, yet totally God, according to that theology. Now, what's interesting is the story of the Messiah is the offshoot of the story of the Nephilim. And everything that happened after the Nephilim came to this planet, everything that happened after the Garden of Eden story leading up to the Nephilim, all the genealogies in the Old Testament, the whole story of the Old Testament, if you take a step outside the box and look back into it, the whole story of the Nephilim, the story of the Messiah, is inextricably linked. The Hebrew version of the Nephilim on this planet becomes the story of the Messiah. So the big question is, and I know there are even people that theorize out there that that somebody said to me once, hey, did you know that Lucifer and Jesus are either the same person or were brothers? And I said, whoa, I don't know anything about that. And but the more you start to look at this, they sound like the same type of being in, if you get down to the basics of the descriptors that are used. And they sound like the beings, all the different characters in history that look like these characters in the Garden of Eden story, in the Nephilim story, in the Flood story. They all have these characteristics of both Jehovah, of Elohim, of Lucifer, of Jesus, a Savior, a Redeemer. They have all these things wrapped up into them. And so you ask, could Jesus possibly be one of these Nephilim? I know this much. In the Old Testament, when the sons of Elohim, the bequeathed of Elohim, came to this planet and impregnated human women, they bore the Nephilim. What happened at the birth of Jesus? You had, it's supposed to be God himself impregnating, or the angel of the Lord descended on Mary and impregnates her, and she bears a son, Jesus. Does this make Jesus one of the same types of characters? It was bequeathed by a character outside of the realm of this earth. And, of course, you talk to somebody in that theology, and they'll say, well, it was God who did it in Mary's case, or the mother of Jesus, but it was the Elohim that did it back in the Old Testament. Well, what's very interesting is when you start to dissect who these characters were, and before I make the case for it, I will tell you this statement. The serpent in the Garden of Eden is the same type of character that came down and had sex with human women and bequeathed the Nephilim. And these characters are all one and the same, and they're all known as the Elohim, the bright shining princes of heaven. And then you come to the Messiah story, where Christians say Jesus is the Messiah. He's the fulfillment of the prophecy. He is the one of us. He's the one that was made one of us. He's the one who is genetically pure human. This is why the genealogies were all established in the Old Testament. He's the one, but he is also somebody that was bequeathed of a non-human father and a human woman. So that is a big question. That's a big theological quagmire when you start getting into that. Because the first thing you will do when you try to answer that question and parse it down is people will say, oh, you blasphemer, you heretic, you backslider, you whatever, you are calling Jesus the same kind of character as this. And really, this is what happens when you have to separate yourself from the story a bit to examine it. Then you're saying, look, I like to say, it's like that great old sage, Indiana Jones. What did he say in the Raiders of the Lost Ark? He said, archaeology is the search for truth, not fact. He said, if you want truth, go down to so-and-so's philosophy class down the hall. It's the same thing with all of this. When you separate yourself out from it and you're trying to find fact, you have to separate yourself from the seeking of truth. And you have to see, what do the facts say? What do the stories say? What do all these different accounts say when you start to compare them? And then I can start to draw some conclusions. If I'm looking for truth, I'm going to be looking for the answers to my theological question as opposed to just seeking what was and what happened. So that's, the long answer to your very short question about Jesus. I think it sounds like he may be the same type of being as the rest of these, and I can quantify all of that for you.
Very good. Good answer, very full. Now, there is a point there you mentioned about the serpents in the garden. Do you think it could remotely have been referring to reptilians?
Yes. In short, yes. Hence the serpent. The serpent is a character in the Garden of Eden story. And if you look at the Garden of Eden story, you can consider it in one of a few different ways. Number one, it's absolute fact, the way you see it there. And that theology is fact. That's truth. That's fact. You can look at it as allegory. You can look at it as mythology. You can look at it as encoded messages. And I believe it's the latter. I believe it's all encoded messages. It's an allegorical story. There may have been a real Adam and Eve. There may have been a real serpent character. But it wasn't a snake. It was a character. He's called something by name. Let me give you a pop quiz here. Were we always taught in church and synagogue, Who is the serpent in the garden?
The devil.
The devil, right. Now, that's what we're taught. The funny thing is, it never says that in the passage. It never calls him Lucifer. It never calls him Satan. It never calls him the devil. And as a matter of fact, the etymology of the word Satan, the oldest chronological book in the Bible is the book of Job. It's older than the writing of the book of Genesis. It's pre-Hebrew religion, and it's got a scene where it looks like something out of the Grecian gods, Olympus. It's got, you know, God like Zeus, and it's got the Satan. It's got an article in front of his name. The Satan comes, almost like Hades would come to Zeus and accuse somebody. And they played games with the life of Job. When you look at it that way, thus Satan existed prior to the writing of the book of Genesis. So if that was Satan, and the understanding that the Jews would have had or the Hebrews would have had of Satan prior to the writing of Genesis, why did they not call him that? Because I don't think he was. He wasn't the same character by definition. But in Genesis 3, where you find the story of the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve and the serpent, and we can tell the story in about 5 seconds. Everybody knows it. The serpent tempts Eve. She eats, gives to Adam. Mankind falls. Poof. They're naked. And I always wondered, that was one of the first questions I had, was why did the fall of man, why was the first thing that happened was they realized they were naked? What did that mean? Why was that important contextually? And when you look at any of these stories from these old scriptures, no matter if it's biblical or Sumerian or whatever, there's a few things you have to consider. One, the language it was written in, and what would things have meant, and how would they have been worded, and why were certain words used in certain contexts in the language? Two, to whom was it being written? And three, what would those people have understood about what was being written in their language at the time it was being written? And I liken it to maybe not so modern, but a little more modern. In the United States, we have all this controversy over gun control and guns and ownership. And you've got the one side that says the Second Amendment of the Constitution, when it was written, meant this. And the other side will say, no, it meant that. And what you got to do is you got to go back and get into the mindset of the founders and the people who wrote the document and find out what was the context, to whom were they writing and why were they writing it. And what did their other works say about that? And that's the way you come up to a conclusion on that. Same thing with these biblical issues. It's all about the context. Now, in the context of the Genesis 3 passage, the Garden of Eden, I believe the whole context of that encounter was sexual in nature. It was not about fruit. It was not about eating forbidden fruit. That is the euphemism or the vernacular that is put on, the encoded message that's laid on top of it. What you have is the serpent character, who is known not by the name Satan or Lucifer or the devil or anything. He's known as Nakosh in the Old Testament book of Genesis. Nakosh is the Hebrew word. And what Nakosh means is crafty magician, trickster, like sleight of hand type of trickster. He is also known as the illuminator, the bringer of knowledge, and he's known as the bright shining one. Now, before I go further in the Genesis Garden of Eden story, I want to bring you up a few thousand years. This is where I say you got to jump around the timeline to understand some of these things. Jump way up to the book of Psalms. And in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 82, you have a story where God is talking to a group in heaven known as the Divine Council. And it's an obscure little verse, group. As a matter of fact, I went all through Bible college and seminary and was never taught about the Divine Council. They're obscure enough in the Old Testament. You only find them in a couple little places. Psalm 82 is one of them. And in this, God is passing judgment on them for something they've done. And many scholars will say this brings you right back to the whole Nephilim story. But here's what it says. It uses the word Elohim for God here. And it uses it several times in Psalm 82. And this will give you a definition of who the parents of the Nephilim were, the sons of God, the Bene HaElohim, who came down and impregnated human women. And by the way, we didn't even mention this. In the book of Enoch, they're known as the Watchers that came down and impregnated human women. Well, it says this, uses the word Elohim. Now, the word Elohim is a name for God used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament. There's many names used for God. Elohim is used the most, almost 3,000 times. And Elohim is, like we defined the etymology of the name El from Elil from the Sumerian culture, El is the name for God. And Him, just like in Nephilim, that Him is a plural suffix in the Hebrew tacked on to denote plurality. So the name Elohim literally means God of or God among many gods. It's a plurality. And unless you have any Trinitarians listening out there, it is not the Trinity. That irks me when I hear people say that, because it doesn't say Trinity, and there is no definition of Trinity, and the Hebrews didn't believe in a Trinity. So this is not the Trinity it's speaking about. It's talking about a multiplicity of gods. And I will go out on a branch here and hopefully not offend anybody's religious sensibilities, which is the last thing I want to do, but the Bible does not teach monotheism, especially when it comes to the name of God, Elohim. Now, Elohim can be used a lot like our English word for deer. It can be used plurally or singularly, depending on the context of the passage. And so it's like I can say, I see a deer, singular, in my front yard, or I see a herd of deer, plural, standing in my backyard. And Elohim is much the same way. And in Psalm, getting back to Psalm 82 now, you've got Elohim, and I'll interchange the word Elohim where it is in the Hebrew. And it says this, and Elohim stood, singular act, in the midst of the Elohim, plural. You can't stand in the midst of a singularity. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, the name for God, in plurality. You are all Elohim, the bright, shining princes of heaven, he calls them. But I could strip your immortality from you and you could die like men. And he passes judgment on them for something which is not cited in that passage. Now you take that and you go all the way back to the Genesis story of the Garden of Eden. Nakosh, the serpent character, the trickster, the magician, the crafty one, the bringer of knowledge, the illuminator, the bright shining one is the definition of his word or of his name. And right here I'll just insert one of the more outstanding stories from another culture is the Celtic version of these characters. The Celts had, instead of the sons of God or the Bene Ha Elohim or the watchers of the Hebrews, they had a cast of gods known as the Tuatha De Danann, or the children of the goddess Danu, who in ancient Celtic in the Iberian Peninsula said these gods or kings from the heavens that were bright shining ones came down and brought knowledges and impregnated humans, and they eventually receded in their importance, and they became known as the Elven folk who receded into the Hollow Hills. And you know this from Celtic mythology. And, of course, in Elven folk, it's interesting that the name El appears there again. But the Tuatha De Danann, the same kind of characters as the Bene Ha Elohim, became known as the Elven folk. And so that's the Celtic mythology. But getting back to this Genesis story, now we've established all of this about the bright shining ones. It says that Nakosh, the bright shining one, the bringer of knowledge, was the one that seduced Eve. The Hebrew word for tempted Eve over the fruit, the same base word, is the same word as seduced. Eve took, she ate, she gave to Adam, he ate, and all of a sudden they're naked. And then they go hiding, and it says, and this is where it looks so much like mythology, but it says, and God came down to stroll through the garden in the cool of the day, and he calls out to Adam, and Adam doesn't answer, calls again, and Adam says, we're hiding. God says, why are you hiding? He says, we were naked. And God says, well, who told you you were naked? And Adam started the blame game. You know, the woman, she gave me this fruit, and the woman's like, oh, the snake, he gave me this fruit, and so God sets about cursing everybody, and he curses mankind. The fall comes. He curses the serpent. And in this cursing, this is the groundwork for establishing that whole messianic story, that whole messianic bloodline becoming the offshoot of the story of the Nephilim. Because here's what I believe, and again, I'll give you the conclusion, then I'll qualify it. I believe the sons of Adam and Eve, known as Cain and Abel, were twin boys, and Cain was actually the first of the Nephilim. He was the son of Nakosh, the serpent character, and Adam was the father of Abel. And here's how it's established in the scripture. When God curses them all, the first thing he says, he utters what is known in rabbinic school and Christianity, thoughts in Christianity, scholarship, or theology, the first messianic prophecy in the Garden of Eden at the fall of man. God says to the serpent, "And there will be a day when you will bruise his heel, but he will come back and crush your head." This is considered to be, by all Judeo-Christian scholars, the first messianic prophecy of the coming Messiah. And then God, and by the way, the Messiah in the Hebrew sense was known all through the Old Testament as the Kinsman Redeemer. And I always wondered why he was called the Kinsman Redeemer. Remember we talked about Jesus, and they say, Jesus was one of us, he's the Messiah, he's one of us. Well, the whole Hebrew thought was the Kinsman Redeemer was the Messiah. And I always wondered what the kinsman issue was all about. So from the very get-go, God's predicting the coming of this Messiah, this Kinsman Redeemer. And then he says to them all, he says, right there in the Eden story, he says, "And there will be constant enmity or conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman," or the seed of the human. And meaning conflict all through time between these dual seed that is created here. And the way that you find out what he's talking about, it's so encoded in there. You have to look at the whole Old Testament story and the stuff that's going on in it to establish this. What happens after that is when you go a couple thousand years now up to the time of Noah and the story of Noah, it says God is going to destroy the earth. What did we learn about Noah and the ark when we were kids in Sunday school? We were taught, or synagogue, we were taught that God was going to destroy the earth because of the wickedness of mankind, and he found one righteous man, Noah, and his family. He had him build an ark, and we know the rest of the story from there. Well, the interesting thing is that in the Hebrew, when it calls Noah the only righteous man in the English, the Hebrew doesn't mean righteous. The Hebrew means pure-blooded. So it literally states that when God chose Noah, he was choosing the only pure-blooded man and his family left. And it further goes on to say, "And he was, Noah was pure in all his generations," back to Adam. And I started to wonder, that was one of the questions I had, why was that important to mention that? Because Noah had to be of the pure human blood, and they had to establish through all the genealogies in the Old Testament, going from Adam to Noah, that Noah was of the not of the line of Cain, because Cain was the son of Nakash, the seed of the serpent that would ever be there, and he bequeathed the Nephilim that followed after him, and more of these sons of God came down and did more and more of this up to the time of Noah. And so you've got this established. Then you find when you go all the way up to the time of Mary, the mother of Jesus, when his followers are trying to establish that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Jewish messianic prophecies, they bring him all the way back to David, because after the time of King David, by the way, the messianic prophecies altered a little bit. Jesus, or the Messiah, also had to be of the line of David and have be a rightful heir to the throne of David. And so they trace Mary, the mother of Jesus, her family, all the way back to David, genealogically. Then they trace David all the way back to Adam. But do they trace him traditionally through the firstborn son? No, because the firstborn son is Cain. And they don't say this anywhere, but they don't trace him through Cain. They trace him through the lesser son, either Seth, in some versions, the third son of Adam and Eve, or through Abel. And why do they do this? Because Cain is not of pure human blood. And so what you've got going on here now is this whole story of the Nephilim, the Hebrew version of this story of non-human entities coming to this earth, bequeathing a race. The Hebrew version explains that and their whole story of the Messiah and the pure bloodline and why there was a need to establish a pure bloodline. Now, it's either the Messiah was there and the Messiah existed and he was exactly as the Hebrew Bible said, or this was the version of the story that they put on it to trace the pure human bloodline, to establish that there was a need to do that. And so you see this story starts to become huge. And no matter what the facts are of this story, one thing is incontrovertible to me. with all these different stories that exist, from Hebrew stories, Sumerian stories, and other cultures all around the world, these 600 to 1,000 different versions of these stories, one thing is absolute, is that there is something huge that happened to the human race very early on in history, some interruption, some interaction. In the Genesis story, it took place from the get-go. It was right there in the Garden of Eden story with Nakosh. And he would have been, he's not mentioned to be Lucifer, Satan, the devil, or anybody. He's called one of the bright shining ones, one of the Elohim. And the Elohim are the ones that are the bright shining ones God's talking about in Psalm 82. And the Elohim are the sons of Elohim, the Bene HaElohim, who came down and impregnated human women. In the book of Enoch, the Elohim are the watchers who came down. It says they came down, and where the Genesis story, by the way, of all this, talks about in about four verses. It's almost like a mere mention. You go to the book of Enoch, and it spreads this wide, cracks it open into chapter after chapter after chapter talking about these beings. And it talks about them having descended to the earth touching foot on the slopes of Mount Hermon in northern Israel, which is the big mountain that still exists there today, straddling the Golan Heights between Syria and Lebanon. And that this is where they made a pact to go into human women and do what? Teach them the forbidden knowledges. And this is what they all did. And so, once again, huge, huge picture starting to emerge that is cross-religion, cross-cultural, cross-mythological, and all it says to me is something big happened in our ancient past.
Mm, my goodness, you must have put a lot of work in to draw those conclusions.
Well, it's I will have some people will take me to task for those conclusions. Not heavily, though. It's interesting. Even those who have said to me, oh, boy, you're way off, they don't offer anything different to me other than, what I would call theological answers. And at the same time, I don't want to give the impression I've thrown out the baby with the bathwater. I have certain faiths that I adhere to, but it becomes more and more difficult for me the more I uncover certain stories. And I was listening to a lecture by Richard Feynman, late Richard Feynman, who is an astrophysicist, quantum physicist, a contemporary of Oppenheimer and Einstein. And I was listening to one of his lectures, and he was talking about the universe and the beauty of the universe. And he actually did this little sidetrack where he got into a little bit about what he believed about God. And he put it this way. He said, in talking about the vastness of the universe, he says, and that God, he says, or one of the manifestations of God, he says, would come here to this planet. He says, here. He says, seems to me to be too colloquial, too local for me to be able to wrap my head around that and all the vastness of the universe. And he says, so for me, he says, feeling lost in the cosmos, I'm very comfortable with that. He says, because I find that with all these stories, I ask questions because I have doubt. And he says, and the more I doubt, the more I ask. And the more I ask, the more I doubt. And the more I do these things, the harder it is for me to land on anything that makes perfect, absolute truth sense to me when it comes to these types of stories. And that's really where it's pulled me. I've spent a life being a Christian and being in Christian theology, but I've spent the second half of that life more or less questioning some of those things, the last 20 years. And of my adult life, I've questioned some things, and I've been asking these questions and looking for answers, trying to find definitions. One very good example is the story of the Nephilim itself in Genesis, where it says the Bene HaElohim came down and impregnated the daughters of Adam, or man. And I would ask one of my seminary professors, I said, well, now who are these Nephilim? I said, I never heard the story before, and we don't teach it. Who are they in this passage? And he said, well, it's obviously not anything extraterrestrial or anything not of this earth or anything spiritual. He says, the sons of God were merely the sons of the men who ran the school of the prophets in ancient Israel, and they came down from the upper class dwellings in the mountaintops and in the hilltops and down into the valleys and intermingled with the common women. And I said, really? That's your explanation for this? And I said, that sounds to me like you're stretching that to fit, because doesn't the passage make a stark contrast in the Hebrew language? Remember what I said about context and language and what it would have meant to the people reading it? Well, there was a stark contrast there. The Elohim versus the Adam. There was the man versus the God. And that stark contrast is there for a reason. And the contrast is there because they weren't the same characters. So this is the kind of stuff that you face from within halls of academia, you know, and I'm sorry, you know, science and academia are as religious as faith people, theological people. Nobody wants to be challenged on these things. And when they find something that challenges it, well, you're wrong, of course, because that's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and then I ask myself, who the hell am I that I would come up with an answer that's better than guys who've been studying this stuff for centuries? And there's my little son in the background. You'll hear the music. It's almost like incidental music in the background. But this is what you end up with when you start to question things. And I think there's more to it. And I think people have questioned these things over the years. And there's a lot more to ask and a lot more to dig into and a lot more to seek. And you asked me at one point about the reptilians, and I never did answer that. I think the Anunnaki were the original reptilians. They're known as a reptilian type of race. And this is where it all starts.
So do I, yes. Now, do you think the importance of keeping the pure human bloodline came about because it carried a particular set of genes?
Yes. I don't think they defined it that way. You don't see biblical writings or usually even ancient writings talking about genetics, but they will talk about it in their own way. When they're talking about a pure bloodline versus a, if you will, a bloodline, what were they talking about? They were talking about genetics. They were talking about something that had been genetically altered. When you're talking about genes that came down and impregnated human women, what are you talking about? You're talking about genetics. So they spoke of genetics in an ancient way. So, I think you've got genetics being talked about all the time in these ancient texts. So there was a need somewhere in there, at least in the Hebrew Bible, to establish that there was a genetic encoding that had taken place and that there was a bloodline that was the pure human bloodline versus the bloodline that was not the pure human bloodline. And frankly, when it all comes down to it, if you start comparing all of these stories, we all have, if you will, Nephilim blood in us, because we were all bred up from one portion, from one time or another. We were all bred to be something. If God created us out of the dust of the ground, or if, like the Lakota legends, that the first man and woman emerged from the subterranean caverns of the earth and first hit sunlight and it was creation, or if the Egyptian Ogdo, the four couples who came down and merged into the on the creation mound near Luxor, Egypt, if all of these things if these are all talking about the same things, we all came from somewhere, obviously. And I have a really hard time, even in all of this, believing that we were made from primordial slime and evolved. As a matter of fact, I take that whole theory of the evolutionary ascendancy of man to task. That is a pure act of faith on the part of science, because all they've got are all these stones. It's like I opened the book with a quote from Henri Poincaré from 1905. He said, "Just because I have a pile of stones doesn't make it a house." And that's the same thing with all the evolutionary ascendancy of man. We have all these stones, but there's no real mortar that holds them together. There's no DNA evidence that links any of it together. So we came from somewhere. We were genetically engineered somewhere along the way.
He's right. Now, going back to the title of your book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, what caused the fall?
Well, according to, now I'm taking that right out of the Hebrew theology, according to the scripture, the Nephilim were were corrupted from the beginning because they were, it was like they were a hybrid race. They were the mix of two things that shouldn't have been mixed. And therefore, they created something that shouldn't have existed. That's the story as it's told in the Hebrew Bible. Were they evil? I don't know if they were. I don't think the intent was evil. I think the intent was on the part of the Elohim was to do something they wanted to do. It said they loved these women. They had cohabited with them. They interbred with them. They had children with them. They taught them things and all of that. But the offspring were the big mistake. That was the in a sense, it's the sin that came from the interbreeding was in the consequences were this race. And it says that they were corrupt, that they brought wickedness to mankind, that they corrupted mankind. And I believe even that could, to a certain sense, be a bit of an encoded message. Did they actually corrupt them with wickedness, or were their bloodlines, the corruption of the pure human race, is what that meant? Don't know for sure, but that's what it starts to look like.
Interesting. Now, you say your book is loaded with the latest research and documentation about ET visitations and also alien and human meetings. Now, is there any firm evidence of alien-human meetings?
No. There is no firm evidence of that. And, by the way, where I know where you picked that up, I never said that about my book, and I don't want to get my publisher angry, but it was the PR firm that said, this is the latest stuff on this, and it's like, oh, wait, no, it's not really, because I don't dig into that very deeply in this book. I stick more to the theological story and set the groundwork for that and say, here is an alternative. Is that I even said in the book at the time, I said, I'm not totally sold on the ancient alien theory. I said, but here is what it looks like. I'm more sold on it since I wrote the book and since I did even more study on it than I was when I wrote the book. But I believe that what you've got, you start to see things that link to ancient alien theory. And by that, I say, again, it's all speculation because none of it's provable by fact. You can look to acts like incubus and succubus and all types of demonic or spirit types of entities intermingling or impregnating human women down through the ages. So in the Dark Ages, in the Renaissance, during the period of the Inquisition, you had the Malus Malefactorum written. And that was a book on witchcraft, and it talked about these beings, these demonic spirit beings that would come and steal the sperm of men and impregnate women with them, and things like that, the incubus and the succubus. And it was all linked to witchcraft and why you should burn a witch and things like that. You start to see all of these things down through history that start to look like things that, especially in the last generation, we have started seeing. By the last generation, I mean just simply like since you and I were kids, the rise of these stories of alien impregnations, abductions, and so on has been given a new definition. It's the same kind of stories you heard 1,000 years ago, but we've now defined them differently because people have come out and started describing their experiences. And you start comparing that to then all the ancient alien study and research that's out there that's looking at all the things that could be called evidences of ancient aliens, from civilizations to the placement of certain, the building of certain temples or monuments or ancient site places. You see them, how they're all connected through grid work around the earth. Even the story of where I talked about in the Book of Enoch, it says that the watchers, the Elohim, they descended to the earth and stepped on the slopes of Mount Hermon, and this is where they made a pact, 200 of them, to go into human women and teach forbidden knowledges and cohabit with them and impregnate them. Well, Mount Hermon sits on the 33rd parallel north of the equator in Israel. You trace that 33rd parallel all the way around the globe to the exact global opposite location on the globe, and you know where you end up on the 33rd parallel? You end up at the crash site of Roswell, New Mexico. Now, that all by itself is either a great geo-global coincidence or there's something to that. And that factoid all by itself means nothing until you start looking at all the ancient temples, all the ancient sites that we have all these questions. How were these built by man and so on? From South America to the Giza Plateau to Thailand to places in the Scandinavian countries and in Great Britain. And then you start to find these things are all linked in this grid work around the planet, lines through the planet, the center of the planet, the opposite spots, grid work going all the way around. And you've got something that looks like it was done by design. And it's in all different religions, it's in all different cultures, and it's in different time periods, but all in antiquity. So the big question is, who did this and why does this exist this way? So when you start to look at what I would call evidences, and I compare it to like in paranormal activity or investigation work. All these people that are any good at what they do with that, even I've done that. I've got mounds of quote-unquote evidence, but is it quantifiable evidence? Is it evidence that science and skepticism will accept? No, but there are evidences there. So you have, just in that same vein, you have mounds and heaping mounds of evidence that seem to point to ancient civilizations that were extraterrestrial in nature, ancient visitations that were non-human in nature, non-human intelligences. And that is about as much as I can start speaking to that without getting into just gritty detail and start breaking everything down. So there's so much evidence that looks exactly like what these religious stories all tell us, and I believe they're one and the same.
Yes. Certainly, to my mind, there is quite a bit of archaeological evidence to support the idea that aliens and humans have met.
Absolutely.
You agree with that, yes.
Absolutely, I believe in that, yes.
Where do you, or what rather, do you think is the strongest evidence for that?
I would, for me, some of the strongest evidence is in places that are, that had been so overworked and overtalked about that people almost brush it off as a notion. But take things like the Giza Plateau with the Great Pyramids, and start to look at not just the construction. And I asked the question. I was talking to Philip Coppens not long ago about this very issue, and I said, "Do you mean to tell me then that ancient mankind?" I was playing a bit of devil's advocate. I said, "Does ancient mankind then did not have the know-how or the ability or the ingenuity or the genius to create these things?" And that's not the case at all. It's the fact that you start to find that these things were constructed in ways that we can't even do today. And using, like in the Giza Plateau, they have found that some of the mortar that was made there, and I can't remember the scientist's name, but he broke down the compound of this mortar and said it has remnants of polymers in it. That's artificial, like plastics, adhesives that are mixed into this mortar. And this isn't just some whack fringe job guy that's coming out and saying, "Oh, I believe it was modern cement used." No, that's not it at all. He's saying that the compound breaks down to manufactured artificial polymers, which didn't exist 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 years ago. At least by our calendar, they didn't exist, or by our technology, they didn't exist. To me, that is one of the big points that stands out to me. It's not so much the structure itself, which you can look at and question how man could have done that, how man could have lifted those blocks, how man could have carried those 60-ton things from that mountain quarry over to this mountaintop and constructed something. Those questions are like givens. They're obvious. Something was there. Something had to help. It wasn't just a bunch of guys pulling it on a rope and a log. There was something more to that. But what really gets me is when you start to see chemical compounds being broken down for adhesives and finding out those are things that we've only run across that technology or rediscovered it, if you will, quote unquote, just in the last 20 to 30 years. So that's some of the big evidence for me is yes. Something as simple as adhesives that were used in the day.
Yes, something that's always struck me as being odd as well when they try and explain it, as you said, like with ropes and logs, is to do with the cutting of the pieces that they assembled there.
Yes.
When the Egyptians only, as far as I know, had copper tools.
Exactly. I mean, look what we have today, and we can't barely do the same kind of thing. What is it in Puntapunku? I always get those words from Punkapuntu or Puntapunku or something like that in Central America or Peru, I think it is. They have all those stones that were carved out and that were pieced together like puzzles. And yet they find that the source of that granite wasn't even in that area. It was over on that other mountain over there. And so how did they carve all that out to such laser-like precision and construct it on the next mountain over? That's the big questions that you have with this. And again, does that mean that an anthropologist will come in or an archaeologist will come in and they will tell you, well, obviously, man had the ability to do that. We can explain that. And they will give their explanations for that. But I also think that archaeology, modern archaeology, science, anthropology, all have a bit of an axe to grind. It's like, as I stated earlier, academia is like a religion. Because what they're trying to do, even people, very good people that I know that are archaeologists and anthropologists, they can't associate themselves with the kind of stuff I'm doing because they're trying to get peer review. And they can't get peer review if they come across sounding like they believe in all this, what they would call hocus pocus, in those circles, because it does not fall into quantifiable science. And so you've got these very good fields where you've got true, if you will, true believers in those fields who believe these things took place, but they can't research them. They can't get the tools to research them. They can't get peer review if they're even found to be anywhere near that stuff, because the scientific and academic communities will not accept them. So, and I rabbit trailed somewhere in there because I forgot what point I was trying to make there, other than to say that I think all of these things that we see in all these old structures, there's something to them that screams that it was a little greater than what we had the technology to do. But anybody who comes across saying that gets immediately labeled. And therefore, you have very few scientists that come out and want to try to prove these theories.
Yes, I think the point with yourself is that you write it as you find it, because you do not have to try and make it fit into a set of firm beliefs.
Now, what I did run into, though, was theological. I have some of my old seminary buddies that I went to school with, old friends of mine. Scotty, you are a reprobate. You are a heretic. You are a blasphemer. You're a backslider. I get all this on that religious front. And that can't possibly be so, because then Jesus wouldn't be this or that, or God wouldn't be that or that. And I say, that doesn't... None of this necessitates any of that being untrue. It just means that this is a version of that. And, of course, when you know the truth and you have the absolute truth in your theology, nothing else fits. And that's what I run into constantly.
Mm. Well, as they say, the world is your oyster, isn't it, in your case?
Ain't that the truth? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, a question here. The Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas all claim to have been visited by gods. Is there any connection with those three groups, with the Nephilim?
Yes. Yes, I think that you will find it. Now, I'm not an anthropological student of the Aztecs, the Mayans, and the Incas, but I will tell you this. I know the Mayan god, Quetzalcoatl. He is the feathered serpent god who came, and much like many of the other things we were talking about earlier, he came here, he imparted the forbidden knowledges of the gods to the humans and was executed for that in their religious mythology. That is the same story you hear over and over again. And this is where I'm in the midst of my research for this follow-up book on the reptilians. And while it's got a kind of a, supposed to be an eyebrow-raising title, The Secret History of the Reptilians, I've subtitled it The Pervasive Presence of the Serpent Throughout Human History, Religion, and Alien Mythos. And so I'm tracing all of these things and how they are all interconnected, how it links into these old mythologies, all start to link together with the serpent being at the core, reptilian issues being at the core. I brought it all up into even modern politics, how you see some political movements that exist today that claim the reptilians are behind it all, like it's we've all heard of the Illuminati. Well, the reptilians are behind the Illuminati. So it's, you know, it's all of this stuff. It all starts to connect. So the Mayans, the Incas, the Aztecs, there was something about those cultures that all overlapped. But then again, they all overlap with Far Eastern cultures. They all overlap with Scandinavian cultures. They all overlap with Celtic cultures and Middle Eastern cultures, because they all start to say the same thing, and they've all got their versions of it. And they've all got their own, their hieroglyphs, their pictographs, their wall carving, their statuary. They all say the same thing and start to point to the same types of beings and the same types of connectivities and the same types of ancient pasts. So all of it is interconnected when you step back away from it.
Yes, indeed. I think the older the history is, for me, the more interesting it is.
Oh, yeah. And again, it's all about decoding when you get there. And the antiquity is fantastic. I love digging into ancient past. I love, as you saw in my own book, I go to, and it's a big rabbit trail in my book, but in the book, I wanted to establish that I believe Moses was the author of the book of Genesis and that he was a historical character. So I go, a whole chapter I devote to dating Moses. Who would have been the pharaohs in his time? What would he have learned? What kind of person would he have been? What were the other stories about him? Why did he bring the story of the Nephilim into the book of Genesis? Who was he to the nation of Israel, and so on? And so when you start digging into these are great mysteries of the past. And when you can start digging into them and saying, wait, I just put a little bit of flesh and bone on this thing, and that starts to mean something, that's when it becomes exciting, is when I can take an old story and start to find out some facts about it. Now, I'll just say this has nothing to do with the Nephilim other than the establishment of who Moses was in my book, but I believe Moses was the one and same character in Egypt known as Senemut. And Senemut was the adopted son of Hatshepsut, who was that remarkable woman queen who reigned her husband was Thutmose II, who died weak and sickly. Her son Thutmose III, her stepson, took over, and she raises her own adoptive son, Senemut. And I believe Senemut is none other than Moses. The dates fit to the dating system as established in biblical times. And so when you start taking a mystery like that, that has no names given to it, a biblical character, and you start to find out, wait a minute, the Bible might be a book of faith, but at the same time, it has some legitimate history in it. And there are legitimate historical personages in it. And when you can start throwing light on that stuff, that's exciting to me. And so when you can do that with a character, what if you can start doing that with the Nephilim? What if you can start doing that with these other characters in the Bible and other religious characters that look like the characters in the Bible? How many of these characters, like Krishna in Hindu religion, Krishna, what did he do? He sat under the banyan tree in a garden on top of a coiled serpent and disseminated the knowledge of the gods, the forbidden knowledges of the gods to the humans, and he was executed for it. What did the Nephilim do, or the parents of the Nephilim? They brought forbidden knowledges to the humans, and they were condemned for it. What did Enki Ea do with the Anunnaki? He imparted forbidden knowledges to the humans, and he was condemned to dwell in the subterranean caverns of the earth forever. And you start there, what happened to Quetzalcoatl? He was executed for delivering forbidden knowledges to humans. And this raised this big question for me. I didn't even ask this in the book. It didn't hit me like this till the book was already done and published. I was looking at the Genesis story. Now get this, in this Genesis story, when Adam and Eve fall, they eat of the fruit in that story, And it says this, and God, it's got God talking in Genesis 3. And he says, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now let us, plurality, let us prevent them from also eating of the tree of life, lest they become like us, like Elohim. Now that was a very interesting passage to me, and I never understood it this way before until all this. First question I ask is, what did God have against knowledge, against humans having knowledge? Why was it forbidden? Why was it wrong to know right from wrong, so to speak, not to be redundant there? But the great sin was knowledge. And then, what does it mean when God says they could also eat of this other tree and become exactly like us? Does that mean humans can be exactly like the God of the Bible according to the Old Testament Scripture? That God was preventing humans from becoming exactly like him? So that those are some of the big questions that were and when you start comparing all these different cultures and religions out there, you start to find they're all telling the same big story. Even within the dictates of their theologies and their versions of religious mythology, they're all telling the same thing, that some god didn't want humans to know anything. And when they did, that's when the trouble started. And that the ones who generally brought the forbidden knowledges were the ones that were the condemned ones for doing so, because the superior god didn't want it. And that creates a unique story. I just talk about it in those scriptural types of terms, but take it out of that. When you say all these cultures say the same thing, what's it tell you? There's some underlying kernel of truth to all that. And what the true story is, I don't know for sure. But all I know is that if they all have the same underlying subtext to their stories, there's something to that.
Do you think that the problem there is that we have the word God, which can also apply to lesser or false gods?
Yes. That's one of the problems. I know in the Old Testament, when I was talking about the word Elohim being used for God almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament, the Old Testament also uses the word Elohim to describe this guy who set up a tent and he's selling all these different idols made out of wood, clay, bronze, brass, and sculptures, and he refers to them all as the Elohim in this guy's tent. So it was from very animate, spiritual, godly, divine characters all the way down to clay figurines were referred to by the same word. So I just find it very interesting.
Now, I think I've more or less exhausted my questions for you. It's been a terrifically interesting talk with you because, as I mentioned when I wrote to you, these are subjects that are of interest to me. So I've really absorbed what you've had to say. And I can't imagine for one minute how many hours you've spent reading and doing your research.
Well, I have no idea. because a lot of it is sometimes when you're just driving in the car and you're thinking about it, you know, and if you could accumulate all of those hours as well, you know, you don't know how much time you spent putting into something. But one point I want to make for certain here is that out of any of this, I don't wish to dissuade anyone from their faith or their faith story. Who knows? I may come completely full circle on this and come back to a faith story. I don't know yet. I'm not done. I'm not done researching. My questions aren't all answered. But maybe it is. And I say, and I'll give away the whole ending of the book. I say it's either one thing or the other. It's the flip side of a coin. It's either exactly like we learned in church and synagogue, or it's something completely different. And you've got to decide what you want to believe and how you want to pursue that. Yes. And so don't let anybody walk away from listening to this conversation saying that they need to question their faith. I say question everything, but you don't need to abandon faith. Let's put it that way. But you can step outside the box to ask some questions. There's nothing wrong with thinking things through and asking the tough questions and finding them there. And maybe, just maybe, you'll end up like Adam and Eve. They found out some knowledge and God kicked them in the butt for it.
Absolutely agree with you. Right. Do you have a website, by the way?
I do. It's not specifically for the book, but it's my personal website. And if I can mention too, I've got a couple of things coming up that your people, your listeners might be interested in. I publish Intrepid Magazine, and you can simply go to intrepidmag.com, and you'll see my magazine there. You can take a look at that and see if you like it or not. Also on there is a link for the book. The book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, is available everywhere. You should be able to get it at any bookstore. It's also the easiest, Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. And we also, if you're interested in these things that we've been talking about today, we've got a big symposium coming up in Minneapolis that I am sponsoring through my magazine, Intrepid Mag. It's called the Paradigm Symposium. And you can go to the link on Intrepid Mag and see all about it, or you can go to ParadigmSymposium.com. And we've got speakers like, again, if you like this stuff, we've got Eric Von Daniken, who wrote Chariots of the Gods. We've got George Norrie from Coast to Coast Radio. We've got Philip Coppens, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns from the Ancient Aliens series from the History Channel, Ian Punnett, and 10 other authors and people who speak in this field. So if this whole topic of not just UFOs, I think the whole new paradigm in that is this ancient alien as it spills over into archaeology and anthropology and cosmology and every other ology in between. We've kind of subtitled this event Revisioning Our Place in the Universe. And so if you're interested in this stuff, in October of this year in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we have the Paradigm Symposium. You can go check it out on the website at the same time as you go take a look at the book.
Sounds very, very attractive. Well, you've really covered it there. You've told people where your book is available. I'm sure it's packed full of facts and information. Wonderful. I have to thank you very much for coming on to my program.
Well, I want to thank you for having me and putting the nickel in me and letting me talk.
Well, there you are. I don't think it's too hard to get you to talk. You're just full of information, which you obviously like to share.
I'm passionate about it. It's something that means something to me, and I hope that shows. And I always say, if you put a nickel in me, I'll talk for 4 hours, so you just got to stop me where I have to stop.
Absolutely. No, it's been wonderful to hear you talk. And
thank you.
To learn about your hours and months and years of research, and we've heard it all in an hour and a half.
There you go.
Right.
I called it Nephilim Light.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's great. It's great to have you on. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, friends, that was a very, very good chat with Scott. Wonderful, I think, particularly if you're interested in those subjects. Next week, I have Leda Green. She is a self-admitted Pleiadian who has incarnated on the Earth. She is here to do healing and teaches people how to heal, and also has come to make sure we're ready to ascend. A healing actually involves advanced methods, and for her, it is mainly the use of the power of thought. So I will tell you that I've already pre-recorded that program. And you don't want to miss that one. It's something special. So anyway, thank you for being with me today. And I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.